I'm told that in the jungles of Brazil that there's a plant called the matador plant. It's a parasite. The seed dropping from a tree to the ground takes root. It throws out its tentacles. It takes root and literally walks across the ground, tentacles reaching out, and then it replants itself in this new position. It finds another tree, and it ruins its roots down firmly. Then it begins to cast tentacles around the trunk of that tree and to the branches of that tree until it has weaved a web around the trunk and around the branches until it literally encases and chokes that tree to death. A parasitic plant that draws out the lifeblood of the tree and destroys it, and once it does it, it starts the cycle all over again. Now, that is a graphic picture of sin. Are you listening? That's a graphic picture of sin, of how sin works in the human heart. And every one of us know it. It's just one little tentacle, and it reaches out and it finds a willing subject that yields just a little bit. Oh, this won't hurt me. This won't bother me. I can overcome this. And then it begins to twist that tentacle around a life, then another tentacle, until at last that life is entrapped and that life is encased, and finally that life is destroyed. And that's exactly what happened to the man of whom I read about just a moment ago, one of the greatest men of all times, a giant killer. And there is something about us that we find in this man, David. David, who rose from the shepherd boy to be king. He was a great warrior. He was a great athlete. He was a self-made man that overcame and rose above the obstacles of his family and rose above the obstacles of his brothers who kept putting him down. This giant killer who by faith in God could conquer and defeat Goliath when nobody else could do it. And yet this great man, this man whom God said was a man after his own heart, failed to sin just like we all do. The process was just like this plant, so subtle, so easy. Just one little tentacle, and then another, and then another, and before long you realize you are trapped. Well, you know the story. It happened one evening when he was on the rooftop of the palace. He was just looking around, and he saw this beautiful woman bathing, and from that look, guess what? The tentacle went out. He watched. He lusted because she was bathing there. And then out of that lust came some fantasies, and fantasizing in his mind, another tentacle grabbed him, and then he began to watch her day after day after day to the point where he coveted her. And he said, I want this woman for myself. Imagine that. But she had a husband. And lo and behold, the husband was one of his trusted captains, Uriah. So what did David do? He piled one sin on top of another. He sent word down through the ranks, put Uriah out front in the battle, expose him unnecessarily, even to death. And David waited, secretly desiring in his heart that Uriah would be killed and then this woman would be freed from her husband and he could possess her. Do you see the way sin works? Sure we see it. The word came, Uriah the Hittite is dead, killed in battle. And now with a little bit of self-righteousness, he goes and says, I will claim Bathsheba for myself. And he marries her. Thus he piles sin on sin on sin. It's like when we tell a lie, then we tell another one, and we tell another one. Sometimes you got to tell the truth. Before it was all over with, he had twined around his life. He had violated 5 of the 10 commandments. He was living in awful despair and subconscious depression because of the sins upon his life, and it lasted for over a year. And one day, this is a great story in the Bible. This is another sermon in itself. Nathan the prophet stood before him. After telling a story and getting a response from David, he pointed that old long bony finger at him, and I love this, and he said, "David, thou art the man. You're exactly who I'm talking about." And suddenly, David sees himself as he was. One chosen of God, one redeemed of God, one used of God, but he had thrown it all away, and he had piled sin upon his life. And so he breaks down in penance, and he's crying out in penance, crying out for forgiveness, and so they have this beautiful 51st Psalm. Expresses his cry, tells his story as he finds his way home to God. You know, as I read this psalm, and as I thought about it this morning, I thought that maybe we all need to think about coming home. Sometimes we get too far away from home, don't we? It's easy to get on the interstate, you just keep on going. How many of us have lost our dreams and lost our ideals, lost our reason for living? You know, my first church was up in Pittsburgh, North Carolina, right outside of Chapel Hill. What I remember about that church was that it was on a hillside. White frame, wooden church, bell tower. Over on the left side was the cemetery. Over on the right side was the fellowship hall. You can learn a lot about a cemetery, about your congregation. I mean, good things. I had one church, there was a chain link fence around a burial site. I thought, now there's a story there. But in a very real sense, there's a cemetery outside this church, too, where dreams are buried, where ideals are forgotten. The joy that we once knew as a Christian is buried right out there. Somehow today, maybe we can have a resurrection. Maybe we can have an experience of coming back to God in a way that will restore, as David said, the joy of our salvation and create in us a new heart, a new beginning. So let's take a moment and just look at David's story. When that finger pointed at him, when all the scales were pulled from his eyes and he saw himself as he really was, he cried out and he said, "I have sinned." When he said, "I have sinned," he was taking personal responsibility for his own life, for his own sin. He wasn't trying to blame everyone else. By goodness alive, that's what everybody does today. Nobody wants to look in the mirror and take responsibility for themselves. They just want to point a finger at somebody else and say, "You're the reason I did it. You made me do it." Nobody made you do anything. You do it because you want to. He was taking responsibility for his life, for his sin. He was not trying to blame other people. Bathsheba, it wasn't her fault. The wives, all the wives that he had, it wasn't their fault. It wasn't the people's fault because maybe they expected too much of a king. You know, we're the greatest buck pastors in the world. I mean, the hardest three words in the English language for us is "I have sinned," or "I am wrong," or "I have made a mistake." You know, my responsibility is not that person. It's not what somebody did to me. It's not those circumstances. I'm the one that's wrong. Dear God, it's me. See, it didn't just start with David. You go back to Adam and Eve. And, you know, in the Garden of Eden, when God confronted Adam, what did he say? "Oh, Lord, it ain't my fault. You know, my wife made me sin. She tempted me." And then when he went to Eve and confronted her, she said, "Oh, it's not my fault. The serpent tempted me." But David cries out here and says, "I have sinned." And that's the first step in coming back home. When we look at our lives and say, "I am responsible for my life. Regardless of what somebody else has done, regardless of the sins I've committed, regardless of how wrong people have done me, I am to blame, and I need to get sin out of my life." And so we have to start with some conviction. We have to start with crying out to God and being convicted of our wrong. And until you are convicted of your wrong and look in the mirror and admit you're wrong, you're never able to come back and come home. And then comes confession. "I have sinned, O Lord. I want to confess to you, I have sinned." It's interesting to see these words that are used to describe sin in the Bible. In this passage, three different Hebrew words are used. I think David could remember when he and Jonathan, they were pretty good athletes, and they were boys playing. They might be playing with their bow and arrows, or they might be playing with their slingshots, or they might be throwing a javelin, and they might walk 50 yards down the road and draw a circle, and they would come back, and maybe they would shoot the arrow into the circle, or maybe they would throw the javelin, but they would go down, and Jonathan looked at David, and he said, David, you've missed the mark. You didn't hit it. And the Bible says that's what sin is. Sin is missing the mark. You're supposed to throw the ball that way, but you throw it this way. You're supposed to shoot the arrow that way, but you shoot it this way. You're missing the mark. You're going in the wrong direction. We were married. We had such high ideals and dreams. I mean, it would be heaven on earth for us. But you know, sin has come in. Now we have missed the mark. And literally, our marriage has been hell for the last few months or years. And that's what sin is. It's missing the mark. I had such dreams and hopes as a young man. I had such high ideals as a young woman, achievements that I wanted to make, and I wanted to be this kind of person. But somehow, through mistakes that I have made, sin has come in, and I have missed those marks, and that's what sin is, missing the mark. Second word used is crooked. Sin is crookedness. It's the figure of a speech of a man who builds a wall, and people come by and say, you know, he's a mason, and he just builds that wall, and they come by and they say, man, you are good at what you do. You build a beautiful wall, and it's straight. I mean, where'd you learn how to do that? Where'd you learn how to eyeball that? And you've just done a great job. And everybody praised him for it. And then one day, a guy comes by, and he starts looking at it, and he said, you know, I don't believe that wall is straight after all. And he takes out a plumb line, a string with a bob and a weight on the end, and he holds it up next to the wall against that perfect line of straightness, and he says, this wall is out of plumb. It's crooked. And that's what sin is. It's crookedness in our lives. And we measure that crookedness in our life, not with some other human being, not with the preacher, not with the deacons, you know, or any other godly person, certainly not by all the hypocrites in the church, you know, by saying, well, I'm better than a lot of the church members, because a lot of the church members are hypocrites. You know, I'm better than my neighbor. I'm certainly as good as my neighbor. In fact, I may be better than my neighbor. You can measure by every other standard, and you might come out looking good, you might come out looking straight, but when you measure yourself by the standard of Jesus Christ in his selflessness, we have to back off and say, I am crooked. I have sinned. The third figure of speech is that of being a rebel, rebellion against God. Rebellion against my relationship with God. So David cries out in confession and says, I'm a sinner. I have rebelled. I know that I'm crooked. I know that I've missed the mark. And so he says, Lord, you know, and he begins to cry. He says, I'm coming home, Lord, and I want to ask you to do something for me. And he says, I want you to blot out my transgressions. That's in verse 1. It's a figure of speech of erasing the transgressions. It would, to the young people today, it would be like deleting a text or deleting an email. You're eliminating it. But in our day, it was like the chalkboard. And the teacher would ask you to come up and would you erase the chalkboard and go outside and dust those things outside. Look like a windstorm out there. And you come back in, you're just full of chalk. But you would clean. You would erase every mark that was made that day and get it all clean. And so the Lord, David says, just come in your mercy, Lord. Just wipe it out. Get it clean. Give me a fresh, clean start. Give me a new leaf on life. And every one of us, when we made a profession of faith, or we rededicated our life, or we followed in baptism, buried in baptism, and raised to walk in newness of life, we have been cleansed. We have been forgiven. And secondly, he says, wash me that I will be as white as snow. That's the figure of washing in the river. David's mother would take his dirty tunic. Maybe it had blood stains from a lamb that he saved, or maybe it was muddy because he had dug a lamb out of a pit where it had fallen, and she would see that dirty tunic and say, it's all right, son, I'm going to take it down to the river, and I'm going to beat out that dirt until it lasts, you know, it is washed, and it is clean, and it is white as snow. And then he says, cleanse me. That's the third figure speech. It's a temple term of coming to the temple and letting the priest say to you, you are clean. You understand, when a leper came, the priest would say he was unclean or she was unclean. You know, you have to cut yourself off from society. You can't live at home anymore. You can't live in the city. Whenever anybody comes near you, you've got to cry out, I am unclean. And so the leper was cut off from everyone. It was a lonely, lonely life. But when the disease had run its course and he was healed, Then he would come to the priest, and the priest would say, "You are clean." So David says, "I feel dirty," because he was dirty. "I feel like leprosy just got inside of me," because he probably did. And he said, "Lord, let me present myself before you, and let me I desire for you to declare me clean." That was his cry. And when he did that, look what happened. God came not on the basis of David's marriage. God came not on the basis of David's goodness or his sincerity, but on the basis of God's loving kindness and God's mercy. So the psalm starts out that way. "Have mercy on me, O God, according to thy loving kindness." We come back to God, not with anything in our hands to bring him, but we just come as we are. "Just as I am, without one plea." And we say, "Oh Lord, deal with me according to your loving kindness." It's broad enough. It's deep enough. It's vast enough to absorb all my sin. If I had a glass of black ink and I poured it out on the carpet here, I mean, it would stain the carpet and the woodwork and everything else. But if I took that same glass of ink and I walked right down to the Okmulgee River down there and I dumped it in that river, well, that river is broad enough, deep enough, and full enough to take all of that ink and dissipate it until it is absorbed and all gone. And that's what this passage says. "Lord, your mercy is so wide in your love, so great in your so great in your grace, and so deep, Lord. Just take my ugly sin, take my ugly life, and put it into that river and let it be dissipated until it is all gone. Deal with me, O Lord, according to your loving kindness, and forgive me, and restore unto me my salvation." That's all we ever want, really. "Let the joy bells ring in my heart again. Those rings that I once heard, the songs that I once sung, let me have it all again. This is the way home. Conviction, I have sinned. Confession, it is sin in my life, you know, that is wrong. No excuse. No excuse. And then my cry, Lord, wash me. Lord, cleanse me. Lord, erase the sin and create in me a new heart, a new beginning. And let me start over again with my spouse, with my family, in my home, in my church, whatever the relationship is, I just want a new start. I just want a new start." And God in his mercy says, "You can come home again. You sure can."